Wanted. Wanted for the crime of confidence game.
Presented in the public interest, this is the program that brings you for the first time on the air a nationwide manhunt in action. This is the program that has led to the capture of three dangerous criminals. From the record, you hear the on-the-spot reports of the actual people involved. Nothing is withheld, no one is protected. Here are the dramatic eyewitness accounts of two men wanted. Wanted for the crime of confidence game.
And now, Wanted's on-the-spot investigator, Walter McGraw.
Good evening. Once again, I'm going to take you on a nationwide manhunt for two men who are a threat to every one of you. You'll meet these men's victims and the law enforcement officials who are out to catch these criminals, and even one of these men's confederates in crime. Remember, these are the actual people, not actors, who are putting themselves on the spot to give you first-hand information so you can bring these two men to justice. And you can do it. Look at your record to date. Last week, you brought in two of our wanted fugitives. Here are the reports. First, from Kearney, New Jersey, the news about James Joseph Sweeney, wanted for attempted murder, sodomy, and bond jumping. First, the man who fingered him.
For obvious reasons, I don't want to give my name. Listening to the NBC Wanted program, I heard of a wanted man by the name of James Sweeney. The next morning, I saw his picture in the paper and felt that, as a good citizen, it was my duty to report him. I called up local police and reported him to Detective Lieutenant Sharples.
This is Lieutenant William Sharples, commanding the Detective Bureau of the Kearney Police Department, Kearney, New Jersey. Immediately after the broadcast wanted, my department was in receipt of information reporting that James Joseph Sweeney had been operating a confectionery store in Kearney for a short period of time. An immediate surveillance was placed around this particular area, and a subsequent investigation revealed that the individual was known as one James Kelly. A further check revealed this James Kelly to be one James Joseph Sweeney, wanted for several felonious high crimes in the state of New York. An apprehension was made.
So, Wanted closes the books on James Joseph Sweeney. Just 3 days prior to this capture, news flashed out of the Northwest on another capture. The capture of the man you know as the cop killer of the West, Omar August Pinson. Here, speaking from Pierre, South Dakota, is Clayton Vickmark.
After the Wanted program, broadcast over NBC on August 18th, information was received to the effect that Omar August Pinson was in South Dakota. The FBI got in touch with the director of the Motor Vehicle Registration Division and told him to be on the lookout for a D.C. Audell, who might come in to transfer a car title. 3 days later, Audell did come to the office in the state capitol building. Mr. Audell, actually Omar August Pinson, agreed willingly to accompany us to the local police department to answer a few questions. I asked the desk sergeant for use of an office and was told that the only available space was the department kitchen. Audell, or Pinson, asked why he had been arrested. I then told him that it was the FBI that wanted to talk to him. He asked for a glass of water, and I told him to get a cup off the shelf and take it from the tap at the sink. This he did. But as he raised the third cup of water to his mouth, I noticed that he shifted his feet and glanced past me at the door that was just to the rear of me and to the side. I felt then that he was going to try to make a break for the door by throwing the water in my face, a trick that has been worn out in the movies. I moved my hand to my forehead to protect my face and sat up erect in the chair. Before I could do more, he threw the water. It hit the chair where I had been sitting. He made the 12-foot dash for the door. As he passed me, I hit him in the stomach as hard as I could, and in turn got knocked back against the door casing. We wrestled in the vestibule and out through the screen door, taking the screen door right off the hinges and out with us. Outside, I stepped on the back of his knee and forced him down on one knee, but he swung back with an elbow and broke my grip. He ran through the grocery store. I yelled to one of the clerks who was standing in the door to stop that man. The clerk stepped in front of the door and slowed Pinson long enough so I got hold of his arm and forced him to sit down. When the FBI agent arrived, he was immediately loaded in a car and taken to the Pennington County Jail at Rapid City, where he will remain until retrieved by the authorities of the Oregon State Penitentiary.
Wanted adds two more names to the captured list. Our record to date shows, out of Wanted's 8 fugitives from justice, a total of 3 have been brought in. And you, the listener, have done it. Tonight, we're turning Wanted spotlight on a notorious pair of swindlers. Two men who are today wanted in more than 18 cities. They have cost innocent citizens more than $100,000. So learn their method of procedure. You could be their next victim. Here are the facts.
The date, September 27th, 1949. The locale, a Safeway store in Denver, Colorado, during a hectic rush hour.
The voices you hear next are the actual voices of the people who, through no fault of their own, are involved in the case of the brothers in crime.
I'm Henry Mefford, location manager of Safeway store number 369 in Denver, Colorado. Along about noon on Saturday, a man came in and presented me with a check on the Standard Electric Company bearing the signature of Ralph Morgan, made out to H.B. Berry. He didn't have very much identification except a temporary driver's license. Sometimes it's necessary for us to play our hunches, and the check looked so legitimate, I accepted it. He purchased around $2 worth of groceries, and I presented him with the cash, around $53.48. I didn't think any more about this check until the following Monday morning, when I was confronted with it by Mr. Sumner D. Dodge.
I'm Sumner Dodge, chief investigator for Safeway Stores in the Denver area. The check taken by Henry Mefford was a phony. However, he wasn't the only one taken in by this gang. Some 7 or 8 of our store clerks and about 8 of our store managers were similarly victimized. This means that Safeway got taken for about $1,000. Upon receiving this batch of bum checks back from the bank, I immediately took them down to the district attorney's office and turned them over to their chief investigator, Ray Humphreys.
My name is Ray Humphreys. I'm the chief investigator in the Denver district attorney's office. Sumner Dodge came rushing in, waving a handful of yellow pieces of paper in my face. And when I examined the checks, I saw that they were really beautiful works of art. They were printed on safety paper. And at the head, well printed, was the name Standard Electric Company. And under that, in bolder type, payroll. In the upper left-hand corner was the cut of an electric dynamo. In the upper right-hand corner, a number, which appeared to have been put on by a legitimate numbering machine. The checks themselves were made out on the typewriter to H.P. Berry and other names. And all, however, were signed Standard Electric Company by Ralph H. Morgan. By the time we were ready to quit at 5 p.m. on that day, I had an armload of these checks on my desk, totaling, as I recall, some $813.50. These checks bore a local address, 725 West Colfax Avenue. And when I saw that, I really did hit the ceiling, because I knew that 725 West Colfax Avenue, if legitimate, was directly across the street from the district attorney's office in Denver.
Investigator Humphrey looked out of the district attorney's window. There, across the street, printed in bold black lettering on a storefront, was the name Standard Electric Company. The sign was there, but the store was empty. First stop for the Humphrey staff of investigators was a visit with the store landlord.
My name is Lytton Sachter. We had a small store that we advertised for rent, which is located at 725 West Colfax Avenue at Denver, Colorado. Last September, a young fella came in and he said that he operated an electrical repair shop at Colorado Springs, and he wanted to run the same kind of a business at this particular address. And he talked about a lease, and I said, well, we'd give him a lease, providing he was willing to pay the last month's rent in advance. And after thinking it over, he thought he'd rather rent from month to month, which was all right with us. The name he gave me was Ralph Morgan, and the impression I got of him was that he was a nice young fella, and he appeared to be honest, and he was trying to get along.
Now investigators had a real clue. The men they were looking for appeared to be honest. This was vague, but it was the only description they had. So they concentrated their efforts on the checks themselves. Question, where had the checks been printed and who had ordered them? Detectives spread out, covering every print shop within a radius of 100 miles of Denver.
Did your store print this check, fella?
Ever see this check before, mister?
What about it, Bud? Is this your work?
They got an answer.
My name's Albert Nicoletti, foreman of Tepper Printing Company, Denver. Fella came in a shop one day to have some payroll checks made. It was an awful hurry for them, wanting them in 2 days. I told him it was pretty hard to make them in 2 days' time because the plate had to be made. He said he had his own plate, which was of a little electric motor. He gave it to me and gave me a small cash deposit and went on. He came back Friday to pick up his checks and paid me off in cash and went on. And the only address I have is address on a check, which is a number on Colfax Avenue.
Once again, the fast-talking confidence man had left no trail. And once again, Ray Humphreys and his men were back where they started. Back to the checks. Back to the phony payroll. Back to the names and addresses of the people to whom the phony payroll was made out. Each name was carefully checked. Result?
This is Henry G. Tormey, investigator for district attorney of the 2nd Judicial District, Denver, Colorado. We had names and addresses of parties victimized by these standard electric checks and went around for days and days talking to them and getting descriptions which were very vague and contradictory. And about all we got of the whole deal was sore feet.
Blind Alley. Investigator Humphrey's men had one lead left, one possible avenue of information. He sent his sore-footed men to interview each of the victims who had cashed the checks. Instructions?
Get them to talk. Make them tell you everything. Even if it seems unimportant, make them tell you anything they can remember.
The investigators hit the road, talking to the victims. Careful talk. Detailed talk. Intense questioning.
How many came into your store?
How were they dressed?
Did they have accents?
What did they say?
How did they act?
Thousands of questions and thousands of answers.
One was tall.
One was short.
Three were fat.
They were thin.
I'm sure none of them wore glasses. I think.
Eyewitnesses are notoriously unreliable. But out of all the answers received, one woman had important information.
My name is Mary Corrado, and I'm employed as a millinery sales lady at the Lady Fair Hat Shop in Denver. One day, a Spanish-looking girl came in to buy a hat. She just loved the hat. It was just what she wanted, but didn't have enough money with her. Could she put it in will call? Well, that was all right, because that was the policy of our store, to put hats away like that. She paid a small deposit and was to come in the next day, but didn't show up. Well, we didn't think much about it, because we hold hats several days. And Saturday evening along, about 25 after 5, a gentleman came dashing in and huffing and a puffing. And he was newly married, and he was to pick up a hat. Could we cash his check? He just got off work and didn't have a minute to cash it. Well, I asked him if he had the proper identification, and he did. I showed the check to our manager, Miss Ethel Todd, and between the two of us, we thought the check was all right, and he looked honest, so we cashed it for him and let him have the hat, along with change for the $55 check. Well, later, the investigators came in to see us, and it turned out that the check wasn't good, and they asked us what we knew about the gentleman. Well, we were so tired, and we'd had such a hard day, we couldn't seem to get together on his description. Miss Todd thought his hair was dark, and I thought it was sandy. But one thing we did agree on, he mentioned that he was newly married.
Not a lead, not a real lead, just a miscellaneous piece of information. A newly married Spanish girl. But the DA's boys hoped to develop that into tangible evidence, and they went to work.
This is Al DiCredico, investigator for District Attorney Bert M. Keating in the City and County of Denver. We searched the records of the City and County of Denver Marriage License Bureau and noted that a Fred O. Brown had made application to marry a Maria Victorina Ortez de Lara. The Spanish name clicked, but we were not too sure that we were on the right track. However, we read the address of 334 East 16th Avenue. 334 East 16th Avenue happens to be a hole in the ground. This definitely established that Fred O'Brown was possibly the man we were looking for because the address was the same which was used on the endorsements of the rubber checks. Knowing that the marriage had not been performed in Denver because of a legal technicality requiring a return certificate, we checked the justices of the peace in the surrounding counties. On our third or fourth try, we were successful in locating a justice of the peace who had married a Fred O'Brown and a Maria Victorina Ortez de Lara. This justice of the peace is located in Edgewater, Colorado, and his name is J.J. Benson.
I'm Jared J. Benson, a justice of the peace in the county of Jefferson, the state of Colorado. I performed a wedding ceremony between Fred O. Brown and a Spanish girl by the name of De Lara. The Spanish lady could not answer all questions in the ceremony. I asked her such questions as, "Do you take this man whom you hold with the right hand to be your lawful wedded husband to live in the hold or bond of matrimony?" And with the help of Mr. Brown, she answered, "Yes." I then said, "Inasmuch as you have in the presence of these witnesses, according to the law, signified your intentions and consent to enter the hold or bond of matrimony, I do now, by the virtue of authority vested in me by the laws of this state, pronounce you husband and wife." They immediately left my office, and the only address I have for these people is the Auditorium Hotel in Denver.
This is Mrs. Faith Venable, Assistant Manager, Auditorium Hotel, Denver. Mr. and Mrs. Fred O. Brown stayed with us. Registering with them was Thurman C.A. and Troy C.A.
Now two new names were added, Thurman and Troy C.
The investigators took the hotel registration cards of Thurman and Troy C. and the newly married Fred O. Brown for a handwriting check. Question: would the handwriting on all three registration cards match the handwriting of the endorsers and payees of the rubber checks? Answer:
my name is Ben Garcia, private handwriting expert in Denver, Colorado. I was called in on this particular case and examined the phony checks. I was then handed hotel registration cards number 8870 and 8871 from the Auditorium Hotel here in Denver. I was able to arrive at a positive conclusion that the phony checks had been written by the three individuals whose names appeared on the hotel registration card, Fred O. Brown, Thurman C., and Troy C.
The district attorney's office sent out an alert to the entire Southwest to be on the lookout for a Mr. and Mrs. Fred O. Brown and two men whose names could be Thurman and Troy C., or any of the other 21 aliases which had been used during the check fraud. In less than a week, they had an answer from Phoenix, Arizona.
Mr. Fred O. Brown tried to order some checks from a printer here in town. Our printer got suspicious. He notified our office. We're holding Brown in custody.
Chief Investigator Humphreys dispatched one of his men to Phoenix to question Brown.
Al DiCredico, Denver District Attorney's Office. I arrived in Phoenix and questioned Fred O. Brown in the city jail. He admitted his part in the Standard Electric case. However, he maintained that he was only a pawn in the scheme and that the real brains of the gang was Thurman C., assisted by his brother, Troy.
Here again is Walter McGraw.
Now, for the first time, the authorities knew the real names of the swindlers. And, for the first time, they could reconstruct the pattern of events that led the C.'s into Denver. Let's study their pattern in crime.
Fred O. Brown met the C. brothers long about 1948. You see, Brown owned a little tavern in Dallas. The place was going broke, and the C. brothers talked Brown into closing the joint and joining up with them.
A three-way partnership destined for $1 million heaven.
Them C's could talk, too, boy. They had Brown believing the deal was almost honest.
Honest, happy Fred Brown and the C's went to work. And the reports came in.
The state of Texas was hit by a snowfall of bum checks.
After several months of hard work, the threesome made their way to Mexico for a vacation.
The seas, they go for lots of girls, you know. Girls all the time different. They spend their time in the bars and the gambling casino. But Fred O'Brown, he meet Marie de Lara and fall in love. But money go away quick in Mexico, so the two sea boys and Freddy must leave Mexico. Well, Freddy won't leave Marie behind, so they figure a way to smuggle her across the border.
Once again, Fredo Brown with girlfriend and the Sea Brothers returned to make a living. They headed for Denver.
At first, they did nothing but ride around the city spotting bum addresses. Phony ones that would look good on the back of a check. Then the next job was to find likely business address. They liked the idea of using that store located across the street from the district attorney's office. Then Brown, using the name of Morgan, was talked into opening an account in the First National Bank in the name of the Standard Electric Company. Brown said the First National still owes him $100.
Denver police checked the details of Brown's story. A quick check with the First National in Denver proved that he was telling the truth. But Brown, when questioned about Thurman and Troy C., maintained he didn't know where they were.
He claimed they split up in New Mexico after taking a powder out of Denver. But he had a hunch that the Sea Boys might be in Texas, since that was their favorite check-passing state.
Texas was notified and Texas answered.
We know the Seas, especially Thurman, old time around here. He practiced fraud in various forms in Fort Worth, Austin, Haskell, Joma, and Clarksville. He spent time in the state penitentiary in Huntsville as number 95166. He was sent up in 1940. Smart cookie. Tough as it come.
Texas was on the alert. And on November 26, 1949, Waco, Texas reported,
"We have Thurman C. in custody here."
Thurman was up to his old tricks. He started a phony business called the Texas Roofing Company. By 11 o'clock at night, he had taken to various chain stores in the town for almost $1,000. He tried to pass his last check at a nightclub called the Scenic Wonderland. The owner got suspicious and called the police. They came down fast and took him into custody. They got back every single dollar that he stole from the townspeople and returned it to the citizens.
Extradition proceedings were started to bring Thurman C. back to Denver. But while Denver was hard at work, C. had gotten legal counsel. He was released from the Waco jail on bond to await his trial in Texas. And while the two cities were bargaining for the right to jail him, he got impatient.
Thurman C. jumped bond on April 15th, 1950.
And he was wanted.
Now both C. brothers were loose again and the trail was cold.
It is not our function to determine the guilt or innocence of a man, nor do we intend to. But according to the facts you've heard tonight and or other pertinent material, Thurman and Troy C. are wanted. Wanted for the crime of confidence game. You can help find the C. brothers. You now know their method of operation, so what do they look like? Well, stand by. How can you recognize them? Listen, and listen carefully.
This is Bert Keating, District Attorney, City and County of Denver. Thurman C., age 41, height 5 feet 9 inches, weight 145 pounds, blue eyes, brown hair, complexion medium. Troy C., age 24, height 5 feet 10 inches, weight, 154 pounds.
Now back to Walter McGraw in New York.
We have tonight two more voices to add to the sum total of the information you've received.
This is Roy Bass, warden of the Colorado State Penitentiary located at Canyon City, Colorado. We have in our custody Fred O. Brown, prison number 26067, who was sentenced to 2 to 8 years... for the crime conspiracy to commit confidence game. Fred at this time is working in the officer's mess and has a clear record. If he continues on as he now is, he will be released on the 28th day of July, 1951. We're talking to you from behind the walls at Canyon City. I have given Fred permission to say a few words to you now.
This is Fred O. Brown, number 26067. Little did I realize that 3 years ago, sitting in a theater, and seeing Warden Roy Best in a picture called Canyon City, at which he was playing the warden, that I would be talking to you from his office today. The object of this broadcast is for the apprehension of Thurman C. and Troy C. At this time, I do not know just where they might be located, except to say that the last time that I heard from them in November of 1949 was that they were in Guadalajara or Guanajuato, Mexico. I cannot say at this time if they are still there, except to say that the kind of fellows that they are, being heavy drinkers and self-made ladies' men, they might be expected to be found in any bar or cafe or beer joint where their type of women would be expected to hang out. This is the first time that I have served time in any penitentiary, and I intend for it to be the last. I sincerely hope that somehow, sometime, that the sea fellows be apprehended due to the fact that I feel that they are responsible for my being here today.
Be on the lookout for the Sea Brothers. Remember, they're fast talkers, smooth operators. Thurman Percy C. is 41 years old, the brains of the outfit. He's 5 feet 8.5 inches tall, weight 148, eyes blue, hair brown. His brother Troy is 24 years old, height 5 feet 10, known to be a pretty boy. Dark hair, dark eyes, affects a mustache. The Sea Brothers have been silent for almost a year. No word of their operation has come to the attention of police since late in 1949. But they are working, and working hard. These smooth swindlers travel from one end of the country to the other. Their victims are always stores, bars, and gas stations. Mr. Citizen, take warning.
This is Bert Keating, District Attorney for the City and County of Denver. The Sea Brothers are undoubtedly still cashing bad checks throughout the country. Their checks, in all instances, will have imprinted thereon the word payroll, which, in the opinion of a lot of merchants, makes the check good automatically. Now, this is not so. Many payroll checks are printed by illegal printing companies throughout the country, together with kits of identification cards that are all phony. I suggest that you know your endorser. Do not be fooled by phony identification cards. Do not permit yourself to be fooled by the Sea Brothers.
You, employees of grocery stores, bars, and gas stations, this is your case. You are the vulnerable ones. You can bring the Sea Brothers in. Now, this is Walter McGraw saying, there's no time like now to wipe out crime. Be with us next week when you will again hear the actual people give their eyewitness accounts of a Hollywood press agent who is wanted. Wanted for jailbreak. All material heard tonight was factual from the record. Real names were used. No one was protected. Tonight's report was written by P.L. Mayer. Music was directed by Morris Momorsky. The narrator was Norman Rhodes. Wanted was supervised for NBC by Joel Hamill and was produced and directed by Walter McGraw.
Hear fine plays on Theater Guild beginning Sunday on NBC.